Welcome back to another edition of the Crossover with Joe R. Lucas, brought to you by 7Days. And today is not only special because it's a 20th anniversary edition, but it's also special because I have the type of guest that I really love to have on the show. A guy that made me happy to retire from this game back in the year 2000, just as he was becoming an up and rising star, so I didn't have to play against him. I love doing these interviews with coaches, active players, but I also love doing them with the legends of the game. And today I have the one and only Mike Batiste. Welcome to the Crossover, my man. How are you?
Man, I'm doing good, man. Life is good so far. Just staying safe, staying connected with the family, and just trying to help as many people as I can, you know what I'm saying, with the crisis and stuff going on.
Perfect. Hey, man, in my intro, I honestly meant what I said. You know, I got to admit, like when I retired in 2000, I was in Greece my final year. Mm-hmm. I kind of turned my back a bit on European basketball just because I just needed a break from it. Right. So I really didn't follow you and I didn't follow the game that much, but researching you and watching like some of these highlights that I've been doing for the last week, man, I'm happy that I didn't have to play against your ass.
Man, that's, you know, listen, man, that's good to hear, but that's also, you know, a sign of respect. You know what I mean? I remember kind of running into Joe Blair, who's, I think, an assistant for the 76ers now. And I played against him my second year in Europe when I was in Biella. He was in Pesaro. And Joe was like a pretty big deal in Italy.
Yep.
And, you know, when we played against him, I was able to hold my own against him. And just to get the respect from older guys that I watched play when I was younger, because I watched Joe play at University of Arizona when I was a kid.
Right.
And now, like, to be, like, kind of on that level now and be respected, it was a confidence booster for me as a kid trying to find his way into this European basketball game, which is a lot of adjustments for an American player, not on the court, but off the court as well. So I was trying to find my way, and I was trying to find my way as quick as possible because I didn't know at that point in my time European basketball was going to be my calling, but mm-hmm. I knew that I needed as much information just in case if I was going to be over there long enough. I had to, you know the rules to compete on the same level as those guys.
This interview is basically, like I tried to like tell you beforehand that about your life and growing up, but you have so much to talk about, and this is the 20th anniversary about your actual career. Mm-hmm. I'm going to try to get through this as quickly as I can, the beginning part, but I do have some interesting questions for you. Number one that I'm looking at, and again, these aren't really questions. This is more like you just showed me I'm so excited about the way you and I just talked, because this is going to turn into a conversation. It is my kind of interview, but I'm a New Yorker. Mm-hmm. All right. So as far as I'm concerned, you know, I feel like you were born over on that other coast.
Right,
you know what I mean?
Right.
What was your upbringing like, and what guided you towards the game? Because you didn't grow up, and I didn't grow up in a very nice place. Yeah. I grew up in a rough place, but nothing like what you grew up in, I don't think. I was an upstate New Yorker, and life was tough. I had a lot of bad influences all around me, which I imagine you did too.
Yeah.
What was that like as a kid growing up?
It was tough. You know what I mean? Because I grew up around love inside of my household, but the main figure who I wanted guidance and information from, he wasn't there. So my dad was sporadically in and out the house, you know? So there were certain stages I would hit in life where I needed just a male figure to talk to. He wasn't there. Yeah. So I had to get all that male guidance from the guys on the corner. You know what I mean? The guys who I was, you know.
And that's, excuse me, but that's usually how it happens to a lot of kids, how they go astray and go the wrong way.
Right. And it's just like, you see all the guys, they're having fun. They're at the park. They're playing basketball, football. They're doing all these things that you like to do. And then when you break apart from that and you start doing other little petty crime and stuff that you was doing, you think that this is the world that you live in and everything is okay, right? I never had somebody to pull me by my collar and be like, hey, Mike, you don't do that over there. You know what I mean? And as much as my mom tried to do that, I mean, we you know, we was rebellion. It was hard for a woman to raise you know, two young men who has this rage, anger, confusion, trying to figure out the world. Like it was just so much for her at one time. And I think that, you know, sports was a way to kind of will us in, you know, like to her, to the family, you know, that was a way to kind of control us a little bit. Because when we really had a love for the sport, academics and schoolwork, all that stuff was tied into it. So there was a lot of things that we had to turn around in our lives to for me to be disciplined and get to where the point in life to where I'm at right now. Because even when I go back home and I see friends and I see, you know, they're okay, but they're not okay. You know what I mean? They're still in the same city. Yeah. They haven't got out to see the world.
Right.
You know what I mean? I think that was the big thing for me. Even though, like, I was in Europe, I was confused. I didn't know the language. I didn't know what was going on. It was just different. You know what I mean? And even though I was miles away from home, I was starting to love this difference. It was a different world. I was treated differently. I was looked at differently. I know I was a basketball player, but, you know, when you get love in general, you know what I mean? Regardless of race, color, how old you are, whatever. I mean, that love comes right back. You know what I mean? So I was just waiting to find my right place to where somebody can accept me with open arms. And I was waiting to give the same love back. And I'm pretty sure you'll find out later on a story why the love for you know, Panathinaikos was like, it was parallel. We was in the same wavelength at one particular time.
What was it though, like with what you're explaining to me, and I don't know anything about your personal life, so this is all through conversation. I'm learning on the fly here. I know in my life, you know, when I was sitting in the car with my boys and they were smoking drugs, and you know, I was in that car with them, and I was passing that joint with them, and I was doing, and you know, and I knew that if I went home and my mom or dad knew that I smoked, they would kill me. I mean, they would have brought me outside and whooped me.
Yeah.
Now, I look back and I say, that's probably that and the fact that I had sports is what kept me straight. But what do you think it was for you that kept you straight? Was it just the sport alone? Was it able to have just that one influence on your life that kept you straight and narrow?
There was a lot of things that impacted me. You know, growing up in Long Beach, California, you know what I mean? You grow up very fast.
Quick,
you know, very, very quick. And I think I got a firsthand education off of my older sister, who was trapped in a world of gang violence, selling drugs, coming home with weapons and stuff like that. So I knew what she was doing. My brother, we knew what she was doing. You know what I mean? But as long as she came home safe, sound, and giving us the same love, we didn't care.
Right.
But I think the moment when she got caught and went to jail, and then we had to go visit her through the jail, and I couldn't hug her through that thick glass that, you know, you see in a movie. That was very detrimental to me, because although I had my friends and stuff who was kind of in the same cycle, getting in trouble, in and out of jail, that really didn't hit me until my own flesh and blood was trapped inside that cage. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I was like, well, I don't want to go down this road. You know what I mean? Because that's all we was doing. I mean, were we perfect kids? No. But when you're not taught right or wrong, you just think that everything that you're doing is the right way to live. You know, just how you say you hanging out in the car, you know, drinking or smoking a joint. It's like, I'm doing the same thing at 15 years old. You know what I mean? Nobody is telling me that this is the wrong thing to do. You know what I mean? So I'm just thinking all this is fine. But I still had the game of basketball in my back pocket, and I still wasn't really serious with the game like that. I was more just trying to be the cool guy and get, you know, respect around the city, because these are what all my boys are doing. You know what I mean? So yes, we play sport, we do this, do that, you know, right when we're done with playing basketball, we go to a park, hang out, and maybe we might get into some stuff that we're not supposed to get into. But I think that, you know, once I had that example from my sister, and I think by the beginning of my junior year in high school, my high school coach, you know, he sits me down and he shows me all these letters from like all these different colleges. And I'm like, what is this? He's like, well, he said, I'm going to tell you one thing. He said, look, Mike, I know what you're doing around here in the city. I'm not saying it's good or bad, But he's like, you got a chance to change your life. You know, you got a chance to change your family's life. You know what I mean? And you can do some things that your family has never done.
So
when he first brought it to me,
he turned into your father figure in one way or another.
In one way or another, yes. You know what I mean? And, you know, when you're sitting there, you know, thinking about this, you're like, man, whatever. Like, this is, you know, this is only for the far and few people. You know what I mean? It's like I'm growing up watching Magic Johnson in my own backyard, but I was just like, I'm not Magic Johnson. I can't get to that level. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I'm Michael Cooper. I'm Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I'm Byron Scott. I'm James Worthy. I can't get to that level. So when people would put this in front of my face, I just thought it was just the furthest far-fetched dream that a kid from Long Beach could ever reach. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, from that second turning point, you know what I mean? I had that buzz in my head. And then, you know, when I was in junior college, you know what I mean? A good friend of mine was killed. You know, he was killed by hands of another man with a gun.
From the neighborhood.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Mm. And to be a, you know, a pallbearer at a funeral and to, you know, to carry a casket and, you know, to bury your friend. I mean, that was very tough for me.
Yeah.
And at that time, I was weighing two scholarship options to the University of Arizona and Arizona State. And, you know, when I'm sitting there looking, I was like, this is my time to run. Like, I gotta get out of here. Because I was like, I didn't want to stay there and get trapped up into a situation. You know what I mean? Because, you know, you can be wrong place, wrong time. You know what I mean? And a lot of my friends have been in that situation. So, like, I feel like if this is my only out, this is my time to go, you know? And from that moment, you know what I mean? I chose Arizona State, and I ain't never looked back since, man, honestly.
Yeah, that was leading into my next question. You went Long Beach City College, which is a community college, I believe, right?
Yeah.
Or a junior college.
Yeah.
And then as an American, reading your story and seeing you went from Long Beach CC to Arizona State, I'm like, how the hell did that happen? That doesn't happen to anybody. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So like that was just a sign from God. You know what I mean? Because even being at Long Beach City, I was basically in high school again. And now, because like, and what I mean by that, all the high schools in Long Beach are now in one school. You know what I mean? So I got my boys from the west side of Long Beach, now at Long Beach City. I got my boys from the east side of Long Beach at Long Beach City. I got my boys from the north side of Long Beach, all at one city. So it just became like this big hangout thing. It really wasn't about my purpose of being there, what I was supposed to be doing. So, you know, I came distracted again by a lot of stuff. And then, you know, my AAU coach, Sam Miner, I don't know how he did this, man, but somehow he got a hold of my transcripts and he's looking at my transcripts and he's like, none of these classes that you're in right now transfer to a D1 school. So if a college came and offer you a scholarship right now, you don't even have the classes to even get in. And I'm looking at him like still confused, like, I don't know what you mean. Like, listen, man, I just want to play ball and I just want to have fun. But Sam was the one that really educated me on what ties into the sport. You know what I mean? Regardless if you play ball, school is still, you know, you got to take care of your schoolwork too. So from that, you know, Sam takes my transcripts. He's like, hey, man, I'm going to take you out of Long Beach City College and I'm going to send you across town to Compton City College. I begged Sam. I said, I can't go across town, Sam, because if you understand gang history, territorial stuff here in California, you don't want to be a kid from Long Beach going over to Compton. That's like a no-no. You know what I mean? And I was already shaking in my boots before I even stepped foot on campus, just because I knew that as soon as I step on there, I was going to be looked at different. There was going to be a lot of animosity towards my way. You know what I mean?
Right.
The only thing that saved me up over there that I knew a couple guys that I play AAU ball with. So they was able to, you know, give a pass to all the other riffraff guys up over there because they knew I was from another side of town. And they was like, oh, man, he's cool. He just here to play ball. So nobody never really messed with me. You know what I mean? But trust me, man, it'd be, you know, I walk on that campus alone and you see people, you know, certain guys staring at you.
And whispering.
And they were just waiting for me to say something just to, you know, get something started. But you know what I mean? I was just so focused on, like, first of all, I was already terrified not to get into a fight because it was like, it was going to be five of them versus me. And I was like, I'm not going to win that fight. So I was like, man, just keep your eyes straight, get to class, don't worry about it. And just doing that to able to wake up early in the morning and go to school all day, like that's all that I had. And that's all my focus was on. But and plus I had a knee injury at the same time. You know what I mean? So I'm rehabbing my surgical left knee that I had surgery on, and I'm going to school at the same time so I could try to hurry up and get out this cesspool, this gangster life, yeah, up in California, so I can leave this shit behind, man. Sorry, my bad. But
no, it's all right. We're okay, yeah, with that.
You know, but it I knew that that was my last chance. And if I didn't take this chance by the horns and run with it, I don't know if I'm sitting down here talking to you right now. You know what I mean? I don't know if there is a Mike Batiste that a lot of people know, you know? So it's very funny. Not funny, but it's, you know, it's crazy how when you really think back in your lifetime, certain turning points that help you steer, you know, in a certain direction. Because if I didn't have those examples, again, maybe I'm not sitting here today.
It's interesting to listen to you, because a lot of people have asked me, and I do a lot of speeches for kids and stuff, and there's a lot of times I really can't define what got me to where I am today. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of love and caring from my parents. It was my brothers and sisters, and somewhere along the line I found the right direction, but I still can't just put my thumb down on it, you know, and figure out exactly what it is. But as, like you, I mean, I'm just glad it happened. So then you go to Arizona State, which is a big Pac-10 school. You do well. Again, I'm trying to get through your early life, yeah, but it's so interesting to me. And one of my favorite questions, of course, of all those Americans that played college ball is, what was it like to play that last game in your ASU uniform and not knowing now? You knew what you wanted to do in life, mm-hmm, but you didn't know where your future was heading at this point. Because you probably, I mean, I'm assuming from your upbringing, you knew nothing about European basketball.
Oh, shoot. I'm actually take that back. I mean, I knew a little bit about European basketball because I would say my senior year in high school, I had a couple brothers, Rob and Keith Willis, who played in Japan. They played in Korea.
Okay.
But they would always come back to the neighborhood parks. They would have nice car, nice shoes. So I was seeing a different picture of how somebody else like looks nice. You know, right, what I mean? Instead of looking at the dudes from the corner doing it the legal way, now I'm seeing somebody do it the legal way and having fun.
Right.
So I'm like, you know, he's like, yeah, I've been to Japan, I've been to Korea, this and this. So even though my mind was always set like on the NBA, I knew that there was an outside world if the NBA didn't work. So that's why I was, you know, always open arms to Europe. Mm-hmm. You know, I started my career in Europe. I came back home, did the little year in the NBA, and then I went back to Europe and I didn't blink an eye because I already had a taste of what it was before. So I felt like I, you know, when I made the decision to leave Memphis to go to Panathinaikos, I felt like I wasn't really going into foreign territory. I was going to something new, but I knew what I was getting myself into.
What about that first trip though, to Belgium, you know, California boy from the streets, heading to Belgium, heading to Europe? That, I mean, that has to be quite an experience also, thinking like, hey, Mom, I'm leaving. I'm going to Belgium.
Yeah,
I didn't even know where Belgium was back in the day, man. I'm going to admit my stupidity.
Neither did I. You know what I mean? So I'm not going to lie. But I felt like for me, like I had a different responsibility on my shoulders. You know, I used to wake up every day and see, you know, I used to see my mom happy, but I knew deep down inside, you know, she struggled to pay the rent. She struggled to keep the lights on, bills. Like, we never went without, but I knew it was a struggle.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I just wanted to find a way to provide to where she didn't have to have that feeling no more. You know, so when I got the offer from Belgium, like, I knew I had to go. You know what I mean? You look at the money, it's something you've never seen before.
What they offer you? What was that first year's contract?
I had $150,000.
Damn.
On my contract. And when you go from zero to 150, you're like, holy crap. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, man.
And really coming from nothing, you know what I mean? I knew how to make a dollar stretch. So I'm looking at $150,000. I'm like, man, there's so many things I could do for my mom, this, that, you know? And I was able to do a lot of good things just off that contract alone. You know what I mean? So the game of basketball has been very good to me on how, you know, I've been able to be a blessing, you know what I'm saying, to my mom and other family members, and to see the happiness and tears of joy, like on their face. Like the game of basketball done so many great things for me. So many great things for me.
You know, it's interesting too, because looking at your trajectory and your past and everything, it's like, you know, you go to Belgium, which, you know, nobody wants to take this the wrong way. It's not one of the bigger European countries to go play basketball in. And it wasn't back then. Then you went to Italy. I'm not sure if the Italian team back then was a first division team or second division team.
They just came from the second division.
Right.
You know, when I got that offer from them, I'm like, man, they just coming from second division. I didn't know what kind of team I was getting into. But again, you know, at that time, the Italian competition was, you know, just playing in the Italian league alone was great competition. You know, you had Manu Ginobili, you had Marco Jaric, Rashard Griffith, David Anderson, those guys down there in Kinder. You had Delfino, Paseco down in Skipper. I mean, you had Tyus Etni down in Benetton. I mean, the Italian league alone was like playing once a week, but it was great competition.
Right.
So for me, I mean, I'm a competitor, and you put me, you know what I'm saying, inside of a box for 40, 48 minutes, I'm going to compete, and I don't care where it's at. So, you know, I'm having fun. Biella was a very nice city. It was a college town. You have a home game. It felt just like kind of being like at Arizona State a little bit.
Right.
So it was perfect. I think I learned a lot, you know, being in that, you know, that league, how to, you know, be professional, how to play at a high level every single night. And I was able to take that experience and, you know, and get the call that I always wanted and get back to the NBA. Because before I came to Europe, or I would say before I came to Belgium, I had blew my knee out in a pre-draft camp in Chicago. So that's why I never got drafted in the NBA. That was a big time blow for me. You know what I mean? Because for the first time, you have something that you love and it gets snatched away from you. And now you're going through this adversity. And then there's kind of like really nobody in your corner to kind of keep your spirits up, because they see you down, right? You have this knee injury, you know, you got to stay 8 weeks in a brace before you can even start walking. Then even after that, you got to play the patient game, right? You seen all your boys, they're still able to work out, have fun, play ball. And you're sitting there in a stationary position, though, sitting here wishing. I had like this rage and animosity just built up like inside of me, because I didn't get drafted number one. So I'm pissed off like crazy. And I felt like I had to work even harder to try to get back to that level. So every time I stepped on the floor, I just had a chip on my shoulder. Like even, you know what I'm saying, my times of, you know, getting in my prime in my European career, I think that's the main reason why I felt like I was the best, because I played with a chip on my shoulder every single night. And then number two, I wanted every American that stepped foot across to the European water, I wanted them to know who was the best American ball player up over there. Now, they probably had, you know, it probably could have been different players, you know, Anthony Parker, those guys are all up there. But I wanted my name to be right up there. You know what I mean? Like even when Tracy Murray came to Panathinaikos my second year. Now, I grew up watching Tracy play in California. I grew up watching him at UCLA, grew up watching him in the NBA. But I'm just like, listen, you come over here, you're going to find out who is the best American.
I love it, man. I love talking to you, because it's the same attitude I had whenever like the new American came over. It's like first, it's kind of like what I was just watching with The Last Dance with Jordan. And I'm never want to compare myself to Jordan in any way, shape or form. But I always had that same attitude. Like someone comes up like, oh man, this guy can play. I'm like, yeah, well, let's see if he could really play.
Right.
Let me get a piece of it. Right.
and again, that's the mentality you have to have. And I think that's also the mentality that Michael Jordan had. He just enhanced it and evolved it to another level.
Right. Exactly. Well, he had the talent to do that too.
Yeah, but those are the measures that you got to take. Like, and you will see deeper into the story, like even like how I found different ways to motivate myself. Because the motivation within the game, sometimes it does get boring. So I had to find different things to give me an edge. You know what I mean? And I'm glad I was able to find that and to take that and apply it into my game to where I can just play with the intensity that I was already playing with. It just, I felt like that just enhanced everything.
you had a unbelievably by what I saw a short stint in NBA, and I want to get through the NBA as quick as we can here so we can get into the good stuff. But it seems like your numbers were good. You got good playing time. Everything was it? Is it like contract issues, political issues? You went to the Clippers. You got waived.
Yeah,
but obviously the dream was taken away from you, unfortunately, and it was just a bad timing of your injury. Because one thing is to be injured in this game. Another thing is the timing of the injury. Another thing is not to be drafted. You fought your way back, and it seemed like you put in some decent time and put up some decent numbers and never got it. You didn't get any further. Is that, is that like something that still bugs you today? I mean, did it cause more of a chip on your shoulder when you came to Greece?
Oh, yeah, it definitely did. From my standpoint, I thought I played well enough for Memphis. When I did my exit interview with Jerry West, that's how it was leading into. Mike, we're bringing you back, this and this, and it was going that way. And then we get through the summer league and everything else, and you know how the business goes. They can tell you one thing, and then in a matter of a month or two, you know, things could change. Again, was I ready for that? No. But I had already had 2 years of professional experience in Europe, and I was like, well, listen, if the NBA wants to play games like this, I know where else, another place I can go, have fun, still play ball, and still make money. And so I was on the fence still of, you know, trying to find my way in the NBA for a second year. And then, you know, Panathinaikos comes in with a $500,000 offer. And when you're sitting looking at $500,000 and you're looking at league minimum in the NBA, what they're paying you, hey, it's a difference, right? And the difference is over here with Panathinaikos, right? You have tax-free money. Mm-hmm. They're paying for your apartment. They're paying for your car. You're putting two and two together. Yeah. This contract over here in your right hand, it's starting to make a lot more sense than whatever the NBA can give you. You know what I mean? And I'm just like, listen, let's go over here. Let's take the money, run with it. It seems like it's a great opportunity. Let's go ball out, do the best I can, and then let's see what we have for the NBA the following summer.
All right, so you didn't leave the NBA with the idea that you were done.
No, I left the NBA with the mentality of going to Europe, doing a year, coming back. You know what I mean? Because when you're that guy, that free agent guy, and you're trying to finagle your way through the back door in the NBA, there's a lot of hurdles that you have to, you know, to kind of jump through a little bit, so to speak. And I just wasn't willing to do all that. I felt like I played well enough in Memphis. I felt that I played well enough to get attractions from other teams in the league. When that didn't happen, then that's when my mind really became open-minded to like the European game of basketball even more.
What did you know about Panathinaikos before you made that first move over and about Athens, Panathinaikos, about the whole tradition of probably one of the best and most historic clubs that Europe has and will ever see?
I didn't know so much about like the history and tradition, but I mean, I knew they was like a good team in Europe. Mm. When I was in Biella, I had a teammate, Malik Dixon and Cookie Belcher. And I was kind of like the big dog on the team. So I had like the American satellite, all that stuff. So all those guys, they would normally come to my apartment and, you know, we'll watch TV shows, movies, NBA games, whatever. But then this one time, Malik, he comes knock on my door and I'm thinking something's wrong. And he's like, hey, man, you watching a EuroLeague game? I'm like, what is that? He's like, man, hold Nate, you know, we got to find it. So, boom, we flipping through like 30, 40 channels, man. We finally find a EuroLeague game. It's Olympiakos with Afonso Ford and those guys, and it's Maccabi, you know what I'm saying, with Anthony Parker and these guys. And this is my first introduction of EuroLeague basketball.
Wow.
And I'm listening to the crowd. I'm watching how the players are, how intense this game is. It's like at a real high level. And I'm just like, I need to get to that level. You know, I don't know how I got to do it, but I envision myself being on that level. So that was my first introduction to the EuroLeague. And then 2 months later, I was able to watch the EuroLeague final with Panathinaikos and Kinder. You know what I mean? Because Kinder was the big Italian club,
right.
And everybody in Italy was kind of behind Kinder to win the European championship. So, you know, I remember watching the game and, you know, Kinder is doing really well. They're up 20 and, you know, it's kind of looks like it's a game in the bag kind of. All Kinder has to do is really just play the cards right, keep playing the game the right way, and, you know, they'll be crowned champions. But that didn't happen. Panathinaikos, you know, they start defending, rebounding, making shots, and then they come back from 20 points down. And it's like, when I saw that, that was my first introduction to Panathinaikos. And I always remember that. Now, did I have a vision of myself playing there? No. But I had a vision of playing on that European level because it looked so much fun. It looked like everybody there was competing. They was all intense. They had like this another level of energy, right? And I was like, I want to be in all of that. Like, I remember after watching that game and after that season, I remember calling my agent. I was like, listen, if I can't be in the NBA, you got to find me a team where I can be in the EuroLeague. Yeah. Because I had that experience already in Belgium, you know, but we only played 10 games.
Right, exactly.
It was like you snap your fingers. I mean, it was like the shortest taste of EuroLeague you can ever imagine. But now you get this other little taste of watching. You're like, oh, wow, like this is a whole nother level that I wasn't on when I was in Belgium. And again, like I was like, I'm just trying to get to that level.
I'm over here with a big smile on my face laughing because all I could think about is the gift that you got when you arrived at Panathinaikos in Selko Obradovic, who I played for 3 years too. And he's my boy. I love him to death. But man, come on. You're American. Coming from Arizona State, coming from the NBA, you're running his Selko.
Yeah.
And I love him to death, man. He's number one in my book. He's made me part of the man that I am today is thanks to the 3 years that I spent with him. But man, that's tough to come out of nowhere and just go show up with this guy. How was it with my boy? That's everybody's first reaction every time I ask him, like, how was that first experience with Selko? I'm like, woof.
And let me tell you how I got it, though. It's really funny. So my first practice at Panathinaikos, Dimitri Tudis is running everything, right?
Right.
And now, mind you, I just get off a plane. I probably sleep 2 hours at the hotel. Now I'm at practice. I don't get an introduction to nobody. I'll just say, get in line. We're doing 3-on-2. This, and that, whatever. But Dimitri is running a whole practice at this time. So I'm thinking, this is Obradovic, right? And the other coach, who's Obradovic, he's like leaning up on the wall. He's not really seeing nothing, but he's just watching practice. And I'm just assuming who's ever running practice is the head coach.
Yeah.
So I remember, you know, we're going through the motions, this. And I remember one of our players had messed up in a drill. And I just remember coach getting off the wall. And I remember him just talking in a very demanding voice that Dimitri wasn't talking in. I was just like, I take this back. I go over to Kenyon Jones, who was a teammate of mine at Panathinaikos at the time. I said, who was this coach? He was like, that's Obradovic right there. And I was like, oh, that's Obradovic. Oh, so I was like, well, who's the other coach? He said, oh, that's the assistant. That's Dimitri Tudis. I'm like, okay.
That's the good guy.
Right. So now I know, like, who was what. I just wasn't expecting a coach to be that demanding like that from the very first day. I felt like I'm this kid from California NBA. I'm going to find my way to kind of ease my way into things at my own pace. But that's not the plan that he has for you.
That ain't working.
You know what I mean? I didn't know about the history and tradition of Panathinaikos when I stepped foot in that gym. I didn't know the pressures of playing at Panathinaikos. I didn't know about the will to win titles year after year after year after year. I didn't know about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So I'm just coming in with this, hey, I'm from the NBA kind of attitude, give me kind of freedom, this and this and blah, blah, blah. And I found out quickly that's not how they do things up over there.
Selko will take that out of you as quick as you got it. It'll be gone in no time.
It'll be gone. Now, you know, it was tough. I would say very demanding, you know what I'm saying? Demands perfection every single day, demands a level of professionalism every single day. But I'm 24 years old, so I don't know nothing about this at all.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Even my year in the NBA, I read and learned the level of professionalism that I had to carry every single day on and off the court. You know what I mean? I didn't have those examples like that. And I think that, you know, when I got to Panathinaikos my first year and I got that quick introduction of what's going on, it was very tough for me. But at the end of the day, I felt like, you know, deep down inside, I'm a man. I don't quit for nothing. Nobody makes me quit for nothing. And I felt like the easiest thing for me was to quit. And I felt that I had to challenge myself to get through that year, regardless of, you know, what went on. Because there was times I felt like I was in his doghouse.
Hey, he ever kick you out of a practice?
He tried to, but I didn't want to go. You know what I mean? And the one thing that I really loved about Coach, that later on, you know what I mean, in my professional career, he got us to a point where we just coached ourselves, right?
Right.
And that doesn't mean that he didn't say anything, but it got to a point he knew that he didn't have to worry about guys getting ready to play for Olympia, you know, play against Olympiacos. He didn't have to worry about guys getting ready to play in the Final Four. He knew that. I mean, listen, he was like, listen, if you need motivation to play these games, this ain't the game for you. So we found ways to do that on our own. You know what I mean? And I think that just took a lot of pressure off of him later on, like, you know, in my Panathinaikos career, you know. So, man, I owe a lot of respect, you know what I'm saying, to Obradovic, even how, like, I walk my life. If you don't give your best effort in life or in a game of basketball, you will lose. And that was my lesson. Yeah. You know, that's always stuck with me from Coach.
I always remember one of the first things he said to me, to win anything, you have to suffer along the way. Otherwise, it doesn't taste as good once you get there.
Right.
And those are words that I always remember coming out of his mouth and going, man, there is no easy way. There's no easy way to take the journey to get to your final destination. And if there is, it's not going to be as gratifying.
Yeah.
And he taught us that through, like you said, through discipline, through being yep. tough. But one of the things I've always said about him, man, and I've had some coaches in my day that were down inside of them were bad people. Zelko was one of the nicest guys you've ever yeah. wanted to meet. And he may be demanding, but he's as yeah. fair as the day is long, man. Yeah. And if you work for him, you got every opportunity in the world to be successful. And that's what
And that was crazy because, see, I didn't know that side of Coach at all for like the first.
No one does until you're there. Yeah,
I would say like my first maybe year and a half, 2 years, I'd never seen this other side of Coach. So all I'm seeing is him come to practice, be demanding, demand perfection, you know, get on guys, push guys to the best of their abilities. And you're just like, man, that like there's no let up with him. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And you knew when you walked through that door in Owaka, you better be ready to come with 110% effort for practice because that's how he wants it.
The games became so easy, didn't they?
Man, the game was so, we'll get to that point. You know what I mean? The game yeah. I don't want to say it was easy. Like we're disrespecting.
No, I'm not saying easy to win. No.
But there are times, man. Especially like that 2019 with Panathinaikos, when you look at that roster, you talking about having 15 guys in practice that was going at each other. I mean, it was whoo.
All right, let me get there. Let me get there first. Yeah.
We'll get there. But
first, talk to me about Panathinaikos Olympiacos, your first Greek derby, man.
Yeah. my first Greek derby. I'm hearing all kind of stories, man. I'm from Yorgos Kalizis. He's telling me stories about how people throw things from one side to the other gym and this. I'm just like, man, this ain't true. I just thought they were just trying to scare me.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I'm just like, man, listen, I've seen it all, done it all. You know me, I'm from Long Beach. I'm like, man, that can't too much shit scare me. You know what I mean? And then I go outside with the ball to go warm up. And what I saw out there, I'm like, oh, shoot, like this is a war zone out here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you have, and we're playing in a Greek Cup too. So this is 2006. So you have half of our fans on one side of Seth, and you have an Olympiacos fans on the other side of Seth. And of course, they're doing their chants. It's great energy going on. You know what I mean? And then all hell breaks loose. One of our fans goes and rips one of their signs off. One of their fans come and rip one of our signs off. And it's mayhem just goes off. Now they're ripping chairs out. They're throwing chairs side to side. The police are trying to come in. They're pushing the police back. And I'm looking at Tunnel. And I see a lot of it's like, you know, like waving us back inside. You know, like, hey, let's just come back inside. You know what I mean? But when I go back inside, I look at Calazis and he just has a smirk on his face. Like, I told you. Like, yeah. So I'm just like, in my mind, I'm like, man, this ain't basketball. Like, how am I supposed to concentrate on game plan, my individual matchup, what I'm supposed to do? And you got all these distractions in the crowd because nobody comes from America playing that way. You know what I mean? So it was a whole nother mentality level that I had to prepare for because I think Orbatovich did a great job at that. You know, the one message he used to always tell us when we had the riffraff in the crowd, control what you can control. Don't get distracted on what's going on in the crowd. Like, really nothing is going to happen. We'll try our best to get the safety. But you can easily get distracted with what goes on in one of those games. You know what I mean? You can easily get distracted in a lot of arenas when you play away from Awaka. You know, Seth was one of them. Pioneer, Partizan is one of them. Like, those two arenas are very, very tough to play in.
Yeah, there's so much fun, though, ain't they, once you get used to it?
Oh, man, it's so much fun. Like, listen, I really look forward to playing those games against Olympiacos. Listen, if you could really sit in Athens for a week while those two teams are about to lead up and play against each other, it's a different kind of energy in the city of Athens. I'm pretty sure it's a different kind of energy in Piraeus as well.
Right.
And, you know, when these two teams clash, it's European supremacy at its finest. You know, a lot of European teams don't have that challenge. And we had that challenge every single year because we knew Olympiacos was a historic and traditional ball club, number one. The ball players that came through there to their program. You know what I mean? And then number two, we knew that they were right behind us trying to catch us. So we had to do everything in our power to make sure that they don't catch us. And I think we did a pretty good job at that.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, you did. I'm not going to get into all the crazy titles because we're talking about the 20th anniversary. It's just some crazy numbers. 8 straight leagues, 5 straight cups, 9 in total. It's crazy. The numbers are crazy, man. I'm so jealous of the success that you had. We'll kind of get into that a little bit later, but the first couple Final Fours that you got to, 2005, I believe, was in Moscow, if I'm not mistaken. You guys lost to Maccabi in that semifinal. What's that experience like for the first time, like a memory for a foreign player? Again, you kind of came over here like me, just blind to EuroLeague finals, championships. Yeah. We were the typical Americans thought that, well, I come to Spain, I'm going to play in the Spanish League, and hopefully we'll win the Spanish League. I had no idea about cups. Right. And now all of a sudden you're this foreign player, this American, in a Final Four a couple of years after you've been to Athens. What was that first experience like for you in Moscow? And plus, you're a long beach to Moscow. Come on, man.
Right, friend. First of all, I'm tripping, like you said, because, you know, in school, when you was taught about Russia, it was kind of like they were the bad people.
The enemy.
You know what I mean? So, right. So, like, even touching down, they already had, like, my eyebrows up. But when you get there, though, it's a whole different story. Like, Moscow is, like, probably one of the beautiful places that I've been to.
Love it.
And also, like, the people of Russia was cool. I never had any run-ins with any kind of other people, but nice people. So my impression of that is, to me, Russia is all good.
Right.
But my first European Final Four was just more of just happy to be there.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I wasn't so focused on winning a title, this and this. I was just happy to be there. I'm on NBA TV, so all my family's going to see me back at home. All the distraction, the media stuff, like, I was all into that stuff. I was just happy to be there, you know? And then, you know, when you play that first game against Maccabi, I felt like I was a step back. And I felt that I let, you know, my teammates down because, you know, we've all played so well up to that point. But even for me at that point, I felt that I played well to get us there. And then playing against Maccabi, they double team me, they triple team me, and I wasn't focused to make the right plays out of that double or triple team. And I felt that if I was a little bit more focused on the game plan and what I had to do, I'm not saying we would have beat Maccabi, because Maccabi at that time, historically, they was going on a run, back-to-back titles. We still would have met our fate at the same time. But I just felt individually I let myself down, and I felt that I let my teammates down. I think I scored like 2 points. I was like 1-4, 1-5 shootings. I felt like the opportunities that I had, I didn't make the right play.
Look at you, man. I had those stats waiting for you. I didn't know whether to bring them out or not. You brought them out for me.
No, I know them all. I think all the good and great basketball players, they're aware of what they're doing individually. And I think all the good players.
But isn't it amazing how you remember your bad games a lot more than you do your good games?
Yeah, because they stick with you a lot more. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And just,
well, they define who you are in the long run, because I've always said that the hardest competition that you have as an athlete, or actually in life, but as an athlete, is success and failure. And it's how you deal with each one of those is the most important thing that you can do to move on in life. And talk about some failure here. 06, the following year, man, you guys win game one against Basconia in the playoff and lose two in a row, including game three in Owaka. You got to be feeling the pressure at this point because Selgo won two in his first 3 years, and now this is a 4-year streak. Not only winning, but you haven't even gotten to the Final Four over that span.
Well, even that year was
it's got to be hitting the fan in Panathinaikos.
Yeah, because like you said, the year before we lost to Moscow, and I can still remember me, Dima Titus, Satsaris, and I'm trying to remember one more teammate. So we stayed back and watched the final. Right. So we watched the final, Maccabi and Tau. And
you watched it after losing?
Yeah, we watched the whole thing. You know what I mean? Well, for me, I wanted to see what the championship was like. I've seen it on TV. Now let me experience it firsthand. And during that experience, I was just like, okay, I see what this level is. Okay. I see what the Final Four is all about. And I was like, okay, when next year we're going to get to this level, I'm going to be more about winning than more about being, hey, my face is on TV and let everybody see me back at home. And I promised myself that. So just like you said, when we lose the next year in 2006, that was a big, big blow for us. I felt like we worked hard to have the home court advantage, to get out the top 16. We started 0-3. We dug ourselves out of a hole. And I really felt we was playing our best basketball at the right time. And then, to win the first game, it's like you're almost in the driver's seat. But, to go back, to go to Victoria, that's going to be a tough game to win. So you lose game two and you like sit game three. You're like, okay, I rolled the dice on a do or die game in front of this crowd. And I remember running out to the layup line. We had a singer at half court. I forget his name. The big time Greek singer, Bazookia singer. And he was singing like we had already advanced. To the Final Four of Czech Republic.
Let's celebrate.
2006. And I can remember vividly running in line right behind Frankie Alvarez. And he's like, this is not good, Malacca. And I'm like, what do you mean? He was like, man, we're having a party like we've already won. This is not good. But my mind is still on the game. So then when we lose the game, I look at Frankie. I'm like, I understand what you're talking about, man. You know what I mean? Like, you can't party and have fun before the fun actually gets started. You know what I mean? So that's a big blow for us in 2006. And then to watch the Final Four in 06 and watch Chesica win, I was pissed. Like, I literally threw my phone at the wall when I found out that Chesica won. Because I was so pissed I didn't watch the Final Four. So I remember Yaka Lakovic calls me. And I was like, yo, Yaka, who won the Final Four? He's like, Chesica. I take my phone, I throw it at the wall because we beat Chesica twice during that season in the EuroLeague, right? And I'm not saying that we was better than them, but I'm saying if we would have took care of business of how they took care of business, we'd have been at the same level, or we'd have met at the same point, or we'd probably been European champions. And at that time, Maccabi, they was without Saris, so they were still a formidable team. But if there was any crack in the armor to get at Maccabi, that was the chance to do it. And I wanted to be, I Panathinaikos, I wanted us to be the team to do that. We failed. And then in this game of sport, you're going to find out you're going to have a lot of failure, probably more than you succeed. And just like you said, you have to find a way to deal with that mentally. So after that season, you know, we take care of business. We sweep Olympiacos. You find out the Final Four is in your backyard, 2007 in Athens. I am fiending for this opportunity. But before that happens, we have two setbacks. Yaka goes to Barcelona. And then, you know, one of my best friends, who was my roommate at the time, Vasily Spanoulis, he leaves and goes to Houston. And they was our first and second scorers on the team. So it was just like 2007, Athens in our backyard. I'm just like, how are we going to get this done? And we just lost basically our best two scorers, our best two players. So I'm sitting at home in California. I really don't know how we're going to get this done, blah, 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 blah. You know, I remember typing on Eurobasket.com. And I remember, you know, like, again, seeing the Final Four in Athens and all that stuff. And again, the motivation went through the roof. Like, I was ready. You don't get an opportunity to get a championship in your backyard. You have to take advantage of that. So I remember that year, 2006, of that summer, the Greek national team, they just, you know, they beat the USA team that year.
Right, exactly.
But then they lose a gold medal game to Spain, and they won the silver medal. And I remember our very first time we met up in, I think we was in Rhodos, I believe, and for a training camp. We did like a small little tournament just because of the World Cup. We couldn't go to Zlatibor like we normally do. So we stayed in Athens, we trained. And I remember on the first day that we all came back to each other, and Obradovich was like, hey, run two side, run fist down, run fist, whatever it was. We knew what place to be in. We knew the timing. We knew what we had to do because we've already been running the system 3 years previously before. But it was an eye opener because I felt like we never missed a beat. How do these guys?
And that's from day one, you're saying? Yeah. That's in preseason, yeah.
From day one. How do, like, I take, you know, I'm away from these guys for 2-3 months, you know, doing my thing in California, work, whatever I'm doing. And these guys are over in Japan running a whole nother system. And the first day we meet up, we already know like what we're doing from years before. So I felt like, man, like ain't nobody stopping this. From that year, 2007 was a very magical season for us because we played at a very high level from the beginning of the year all the way to the end of the year. And when you look at a lot of teams from NBA to Europe, that doesn't happen a lot. You know, some teams, they start, you know, a little slow, and then there's a certain part in the season that they peak, right? And then they start playing better. That 07 year, right from the beginning, we was lights out. I think we won, I don't know, 20-something games in a row before we lost our first game. But we were so focused and determined to be one of the four teams in the Final Four that from the start of training camp, we was on a mission. And throughout the year, I think we let our game do the talking, and we just, hey, made it a point to let everybody know that we're going to be one of the four teams in the Final Four.
What was it like for you then? Because you mentioned earlier how, I don't know, you didn't say it in a way of regret or anything like that, but you did mention the fact that you probably didn't approach your first Final Four the way you obviously would have approached your second one in 2007.
Right.
But there is the distraction, as you talked about earlier. Now there's a distraction of being at home, because that enters into the distractions too. So how did you change your attitude towards, you know, the focusing for the Final Four? Because if it's in, you know, if it's in Madrid or if it's in Paris or if it's in London, you're there and you're focused. Now all of a sudden you're in your second Final Four. You lost the first one. In your mind, you had a bad game, and you were distracted by outside things. Right. It's not so easy to stay focused in your own hometown either.
It wasn't. I had family. I had my mom, brothers, sisters. I had my wife's family up over there. I had like 12, 13, 14, 15 people. So, yeah, my house was crazy. But we were staying at the hotel. I was able to, you know, get myself away from the distraction at home and focus on the task at hand with my teammates and everybody else at the hotel. That was one of them. Number two, again, we lost the 2005 Final Four, and then the year after that in 06, we lose to Tau. So now 2007 comes, semifinal, first game we play against is Tau. Now, this is not no redemption.
Hey, I love doing these interviews with you because you're just walking me right into my – I could have just asked you two questions in the beginning and you could have just done the whole interview for me.
So it's just like it's no revenge game.
Oh, come on. Mike, I've been talking to you for almost an hour. It's all revenge. They were 12-2. They went 6-0 in the top 16. They swept Olympiacos 2-0, and they beat y'all in your home court last year. Yeah. You don't tell me that's not a revenge game.
Maybe for some people, but let me tell you why it wasn't a revenge game for us. Because we were so
determined. All right, let me hear
we
this.
We were so determined about the end result. We didn't care. Like, you know what I'm saying? And the one thing I like about Obradovich, he made sure to let you know that the past is the past, right? So you can't dwell on anything. And I couldn't make it a personal mission to make it a revenge game, right? Because I have Luis Scola across from me, Tiago Splitter, guys that I really respect, guys that I have to game plan for and get ready to play. You know what I mean? Because those guys ain't no scrubs. So we had to remain focused on the game plan, not Tau and not what happened in 2006. And I think that's why Obradovich is one of the greatest coaches of all time, if not the greatest coach, you know what I'm saying, in Europe, because there's no better coach that can get you focused on a game than him.
It's crazy.
You know,
it's crazy, isn't it?
It's totally unreal, like for real. I don't know. He don't have no magic wand. He don't sprinkle around no fixie, no fairy dust or nothing like that. It's clear, cut, and dry. And if you want to win, you want to win. And from the experience that I had, like you said, like 05, I was just happy to be there, and I lost. Mm-hmm. So now I'm like, well, listen, let me go in here, focus, do everything that I'm supposed to do in terms of studying the game plan, studying my individual matchups and what I want to do. And if we win this time, then I'm like, oh, shoot. Then it's like you stay that way, right? So, you know, we kick down the door, and, you know, we beat Tau. And now we have Cheska right in front of us, who's the European champions previous year before. We finally, you know, got to them and was able to prevail. And to win that first European championship, that was beautiful, man. And number two is that everything that we went through with Coach, whether he yelled at us and we didn't like it, whether we practiced a little bit too long and we didn't like it, we bought into everything that he put us through now. So now, when coaches like do this, do that, and what now when he preaches and teaches stuff, everything is believable because we want it on the same format, on the same principle, on the same philosophy that he's preaching. So now everything's a buy-in factor now. You know, if we're playing Maccabi and we have to change up our defense just because of a specific player, all 15 guys are bought in to that adjustment. You know what I mean? Because we've done it. The recipe to success has already been granted upon us by winning the European Championship in 07. So now after that, 2008, 2009, the year after, the recipe to success was already planted into the soil. And all we had to do was come in, work hard, bust our ass, listen to coach, you know what I mean, and do what we need to do. And we was going to be fine, win or lose, right? I thought that we was a team that understood how to lose, but we value how to win more. So let's say, like, you know, we lose a game, a two-point game, whatever it was, before we even get into that heated video session with Obradovich, because, you know, he's going to let you know what you did wrong. We have already gotten on ourselves. We have already made the corrections of, like, this is the adjustment that I have to make for next game, or this is the adjustment that I have to make for my team, for us to keep the offense moving well, keep the defense moving well. So again, you've been able to coach yourself. And by that, I became a student of the game, right? So
exactly.
So like I studied more. And what I mean by studying, I don't mean that I was all with laptop computer breaking things down that I do now as an assistant coach for the Orlando Magic, but the blueprint was on every night. You know what I mean? Wednesday night, it was EuroLeague games on. After practice, I would run home and go watch those games. And I will see Luis Scola, whoever's playing, and I'll just take one thing from Luis Scola, I will put it in my game. You know what I mean? Like I was trying to take
right.
one, two things from these guys and put it in my game. So I was studying at the same time I was watching. You know what I mean? And these are like what I tell some of our young guys now with Orlando, like, hey, man, the blueprint is on TV every single night. If you're a fan of the game, just sit there and watch. The game will talk to you without even saying a word. You know what I mean?
That's so true.
It is so true. It is so true.
Hey, hey, what a brilliant chat that was with Mike Batiste. But guess what, fans? It's not over yet. We got a second part of that exclusive interview coming up on the next edition of the Crossover Podcast with me, Joe R. Lucas. Remember to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can also contact us on Facebook or Twitter using that hashtag, you know it, EL Crossover. But until next time, it's goodbye.